Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you guys for inviting me up here this weekend. It's quite an honor to be up here, and I got to drive around with Stan all day. And he was on the phone the whole time. And he's got one of these ear things, you know, and I can't see it from the passenger side. So a lot of the times I thought he was talking to me, you know. And anyway, I had a good ride out here. Glad to be here. Couldn't make it out of the airport, though. I had a tough time getting out of the airport. A couple years ago, my doctor told me that I needed to start taking Metamucil. And so I tried to bring some. Well, I did bring some. I put it in a little baggie in my briefcase. And because I didn't want to take the big jar. You know, they might think I have a problem. And I got about four fingers of it, and it's in a baggie, and there's a big tablespoon in there, you know. And everything's going all right, you know, and I'm getting checked out and everything, and I've got this little fella from India who works for the security. I need you to come over here. I said, what? He said, I need to talk to you. I said, what's up? He says, what is this? And he has this bag of Metamucil. I go, oh, I said, that's my Metamucil. Meta what? I said, it's my Metamucil. What is it for? I says, well, you know, it makes me regular. What's not regular with you? You know, and I said, Jesus, you know. I said, well, it helps me poo-poo. Poo-poo? You can't poo-poo? This time, you know, what's wrong with your poo-poo? Now everybody's looking, you know. And some guy finally tells him what's going on, you know, and he lets me through. And it was like, you know, before I come to AA, I was going back and forth from Tijuana smuggling stuff and never got caught. Now I'm 24 years sober and I'm going to do time for four fingers of Metamucil, you know. But I'm glad to be here. I know a lot of you here, so this is really good. We've known a lot, and it's always good to get away. And but the important thing is, I'm kind of a funny guy. A lot of people are into finding their satisfactions now that they're sober and trying to get to a place where they're satisfied. And I'm kind of a goofy guy. I hope I'm never satisfied with what I do in AA. I hope I never get to the place where I think that I'm all done and I don't need to do any more. I hope I always have this hunger for Alcoholics Anonymous that you people have installed in me. You know, a divine thirst, as they call it. Because it really is a wonderful way of life. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 25 years and not amount to a damn thing. He says, you're not all, you know, he says, you're not much, but, you know, you're all you think about, you know. And I've always been consumed in me, you know. I've always been kind of restless and irritable and discontented, you know. I was in the middle of three kids, and I was sure that they were getting all the attention. I've always had a chip on my shoulder. I've always been kind of hostile, you know. Always had this uncertainty about things, and I've always been a loser. Always been a loser. And when you're a loser, it seems like when you grow up, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to, you know, to help you along. You know, why don't you kind of be like Bobby, you know? And I remember being a freshman in high school, and I got caught being drunk, and me and my dad are in the principal's office. My dad looks up on the side there, and he says, a star quarterback. He says, why don't you try to be like Coy? I look at him. I says, all right, I'll try to be like Coy. And the next year, I got caught for being loaded on Reds and being drunk, and I drove the janitor's cart through the library door. You know, seems like I had to get that book back, you know. And me and my dad and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, you know, and my probation officer says, you know, why don't you try to be like Coy? He seems to be doing pretty good, you know, and he's playing football and everything. And I said, all right. Next year, my sister starts dating this guy, and she brings him over. And it's stall number 7 right there in the house, you know. And my mom comes running over in her muumuu, and she says, you know, why don't you try to be like Coy, for Christ's sakes, you know. I said, all right. And the next year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days, and the newspaper comes sliding under, and it says that all, you know, Coy makes all pro CIF. And I said, God, I'd like to be like Coy. You know, this guy's moving right along, man, you know. And it seems like what goes around comes around in old A&A town. I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in my van, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles. And it seems like it's vogue in Los Angeles that on every street corner, somebody's selling oranges or peanuts, or they have this big cardboard sign that says, I'll work for food, you know, like you don't, you know. And, you know, and I, you know, and people are always, I've got stuff in my pockets of telling me Jesus is coming and Jehovah's going to be here. And, you know, all these people are coming. I got to go see them, you know. And this guy's holding up the sign, you know, and my window's down, and he locks eyes with me. And I said, oh, shit. You know, I got $2 and he ain't getting it, you know, because, you know, I'm the cookie lady at my meeting, you know. And sure enough, he comes running over, sticks his little greasy head in my van, and he goes, Larry, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy, it's old number 7, man. And I said, my God, you know, I thought this guy had it made. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that my sponsor would shoot this guy a letter saying, why don't you be like Larry? You know what I mean? This guy, I mean, he had it made. And you know what? Everybody's always looked like they've had it made. Everybody's always looked like they've had everything dialed in, man. And it seemed like the harder I tried, the worse things it got, you know. And I come from a great family. You know, I can't pin the rap on that. I was born in Detroit, and I come out to California when I was about 4 years old and brought up in a little foster home for a while. My mom and dad split up, and God, my mom, she's a great lady. She still is. Love her to death. And my mom is a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. My mom loved that speed. My mom was always running around the house around 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage, you know, or raking the neighbor's yard around 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. And her favorite thing was to get that prescription filled and start edging the whole house and making these Afghans, you know. And everything in the house had a fresh Afghan, you know. The chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles she had knit, you know. Any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And everything was made that night. Just, you could hear her in the other room, man, just going to town, just a busy little lady, man, you know, and I loved her to death, man. Every now and then she'd get the gas edger and just do the whole block, you know, just moo-moos flying all over the place, you know, I loved her to death. I loved her to death. I still do. Her favorite hobby is when she could get them down to one, she'd get that prescription filled, and she'd go to Savon's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had coupons. And she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And then she'd get these big 50 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know. It's going to be an all beige night. She don't want to be stopped by any color, you know. And she'd come home, put her one and only muumuu on, you know, and eat about 3 more Dexies and start putting together this puzzle. And she gets so into it that if she had a piece that didn't fit, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that son of a bitch down, you know. And I tell you, man, I loved being around my mom. I loved being around her. She was just a, you know, I love being around her. But I never want to forget what it was like. And I knew my mom loved me. And I was to start a pattern with that I would take with me to up until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, when anybody would ever show me any ounce of attention or affection, I would play them like a fiddle. And I don't ever want to forget that my mom not seeing me for a little over a year, and I come out of an institution, and on a cold April morning, she's working at her dry cleaners, and I'm standing in the parking lot, and it's raining, and I'm about from here to the coffee pot. And I'm standing there, and I'm staring at her. And I'm shaking, and I'm alone. And the only thought that I have is she better have a dollar for me to make that walk across that parking lot and go up to that little lady who hadn't seen her son and ask her for that dollar and to have her get out her little plastic wallet that she got at Woolworths, to thumb through it and to see a picture of me when I'm 8 years old on a baseball team fall out, for her to give me $1, $2, and for her to give it to me. And as I'm turning to leave, she says, Larry, she says, what would it cost to get my son back? For me to run down to that alley, to go back to Wilmington where I was living, you see. I never want to forget that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back here to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, when I am sober, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. And the longer I stay sober, the deeper the roots get. And I see how in every little crack in my life, it was all about me and still can be today, you know. And I didn't want to do that to my mom. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He loved to drink and he loved to sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, you know. And he'd always be sneaking through my bedroom window, you know. And I can tell because he's got these big old greasy Frankenstein boots, you know. And he'd be coming in there, sneaking in right on my chest, you know. And I'd grab his little leg and I said, hey, you know, why don't you have mom make you a set of keys, you know. My God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I tell you, man, my dad was the epitome. My dad was my hero. Oh, man, my dad made being a man look like the thing to do. My dad's the kind of guy that everything he touched turned to gold. My dad had a character about him that he would just hang in. He would never just start something and blow it off. He started something and he finished it. You know, he's the kind of guy that started off at a refinery in California as a janitor maintenance man, stayed there 35 years and became the plant manager, head of OSHA. You know, and he had a hell of a life, man. His father choked on his tongue when he was 12 in a hotel and died in alcoholic convulsion. His mother died when he was 15. She hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. You know, and his whole life was geared about helping his kid brother and getting my mom out of that convent and marrying her and going into the war. And their dream was after the World War II to come to California and live that dream that the people back there had. And I became the nightmare of that dream. And I tell you, I worshiped the ground. I wanted my dad's approval so much that I avoided my mom like the plague just to get that old man's approval. And you know what? I'd already had it, but not in the ways that I needed it. I had it from our first encounter. My dad always wanted the best for me, but I always thought that my dad wanted me to. I had these ideas that he wanted me to be like him and stuff like that, you know. And now, along with being an alcoholic, I have another problem, and that is I have a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here, you know. And when you have an ego like mine, and you're a something-for-nothing guy, and you've got this lazy ass, you grow up your whole life doing average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah. I'm the type of guy that goes to work, and I put 8 hours in, and I think the boss is up in the window going, oh, Jesus Christ, man. Look at that guy, man. And he only put in a half-hour lunch. Boy, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. You know, and I'm like that today, you know. I put a toilet seat on for my wife, you know, several months ago. And it was a nice piece of cherry wood. I put that thing in there, you know, and every time, and she's busy in AA, and I'm busy, and every time we'd come home from our meetings, she'd go into the bathroom, and I'd go to the bedroom, and I'd be sitting in bed, you know, and she'd be in there doing her stuff, and I'd be just rocking on that bed, man. Just, come on, Rosie. Jesus, man, get out of yourself, you know. You know? How selfish can you be, you know? That's a brand new piece of wood you're sitting on in there, man. Yeah. Who do you think put it on? God, you know? God didn't put it. It was Lawrence of Torrance that put that damn thing on there, you know? And I after 3 months, I had to tell her. I said, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood. She goes, oh, I know, and it's loose, too. You can't make these ladies happy around here, you know? You're never happy, you know? And this week, we got a new oven, our first new oven, and something was wrong with the clock, and she wanted me to fix the clock. I'm not a clock fixer. I'm a plumber. What do I know about clocks? You got a goddamn watch, for Christ's sake, you know? Would you fix it? You know, I said, what do you want me to do? It's under guarantee. Can you just look at it? Okay, you know, I'm muscling that thing out, you know, and I'm looking at this clock, you know, and I don't know nothing about clocks, you know, and I just stare at it and growl, you know. And she looks at me across the oven. She says, "Do you know how sexy you look when you're working?" I says, "You bet I do. You bet I do. My entire life I've known how sexy I was, you know. I drank to get ugly like you, for Christ's sakes, you know. You know, and I almost fell for the biggest con there was, the old chores through your drawers con, you know what I mean? My poor wife, I finally got everything fixed up. But I'm like that, you know, and growing up in that house and wanting to please my dad in ways that weren't necessary, and it seemed like the older I got, the more restless and irritable and discontented I got. Didn't know how to talk to people in my own home, and I felt ashamed for that. And the biggest thing that I felt ashamed for was that there was nothing in that home, even though it was small and we didn't have a lot of dough, there was nothing in that house to validate how crazy I felt. There was nothing really to... Oh, yeah, I could come up with some nickel and dime things, but you know what? Not for as goofy as I felt. I could do everything that everybody else in that neighborhood could do. Play baseball, get D's, you know, whatever it is, but... But there was a part of me that wasn't quite right. There was a part of me that, you know what? I can never let anybody find out how goofy I feel, you know? And around 11 years old, there's about four of us, and we're in a garage, and we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I felt normal. And that had been my dream until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wasn't to be a plumber, wasn't to be sober, was one of these days, I'm going to think and feel and be normal, because I know there was a part of me that wasn't. And I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, man, and it just shut off my head, took off the grinding, and for a moment in time, everything was all right with Larry. There was no need to compare, there was no need to wonder, there was no need to do anything but have another drink, because I'd found something that people around me seemed to get with normal living. And that was peace of mind. I never had peace of mind. And you know, that kind of tricked me when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It kind of tricked me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would see people come to these rooms, and to the untrained eye, it looks like they stop drinking, and they get a little room, and they get a little job, and they get a little car, and they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth, because there's people sitting in this room right now with every material instinct satisfied, but they are restless, irritable, and discontented because the solution of alcoholism isn't taking place in their life. There's a picture that I love in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know a lot of you are familiar with it, and that's the man on the bed with those two guys talking to him. And that's alcoholic number three on that bed. Now, do you really think that Bob and Bill are telling that guy, "Hey, looks like you need to have a little more overtime in your life, pal. Looks like you need to spend more time at work"? I don't think so. I don't think that's what they have in mind here, you know. But I was sure that, and that had been my plague my whole life, man. If I could just get some type of normal living, that maybe I won't have to drink the way I do and do the things the way I do, you know. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that I had a phenomenon of craving. At 11 years old, I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, and all I know that little Larry was all right. He was not as goofy as he thought for a little bit. And I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day or nothing like that, but I got the address, you know, and and going to school and trying to hide it and stuff like that. And it seemed like for me, for a long, long time, I don't know about you, but for a long, long time, I would take a shot of alcohol. Boom, beautiful picture would open up. It was beautiful. Every time I took a shot of alcohol, poof, this beautiful picture took place, man. And I was safe and everything was okay. And for a long, long time, I could guarantee that. every time I drank, boom, this beautiful picture, and I was in it, would happen. And then something happened to me. It seems like the longer I drank, the smaller the picture got. And the smaller the picture got. And the smaller the picture got. And my demand for it to open up became greater. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't a picture left. There was just some son of a bitch in a mission looking through a keyhole, hoping that that thing would open up. Just hoping that that next drink would pop open just a little bit. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just drinking for just the hope of that picture to happen, no matter how small it was. And I would get physically drunk and mentally ill, and I couldn't tell the difference between drinking and my sobriety. There was no difference. Just one had an odor. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and drinking's been your best friend, and sobriety your biggest enemy, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because all my life, I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. It seemed like sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. And I would not drink, and I would come to these meetings, and I would see these guys with these ties on, standing at these boxes going, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, and I was, my God, I came in with that guy. You know what I mean? And our book in the doctor's opinion talks about that. In that paragraph, it says that the only answer is entire abstinence. And then it's followed by the most beautiful paragraph. It says, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. Alkies have been debating that, and that's what drives psychiatrists mad. That's what drives the medical profession out of their mind. Is they're sure that if we don't drink, everything would be all right. And when the alcoholic of my type stops drinking, his life gets so damn miserable that he has to drink just to preserve his sanity. And a lot of people would think, well, my God, you know, the memory of your last drunk should keep you sober, but not to the alcoholic. The memory of his last drunk starts fading away because of the pain that he feels today. And that becomes greater than the memory and greater than the memory. And pretty soon he needs a shot just to shut it off, you know. And that's what's so amazing, is that we have consequences. We've got little loved ones begging. We've got chunks of liver in our pants. We've got, you know, we've got a court day. We've got people leaving. We've got every reason to stop. And yet the alcoholic is the only one that'll push all that evidence aside for, let me have a half pint of PM bourbon. You know, figure that out. You know, figure that one out. Not too long ago, they came out with a pill for alcoholism. They made it in Switzerland. There was a pill for the cure of alcohol. My first thought is, I wondered what two would do, you know. And so anyway, I, like I said, and then when I got into high school, you know, you couldn't always come in drunk, and so I would start taking barbiturates, and I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers that liked cars, and I liked cars, and we used to lower our cars down and get our hair up real big, you know, and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it, man. I loved it, man. We had our cars down real low, and I had my hair up real big, you know, and white T-shirts and black khaki pants that came up to here, you know, and all the women said men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and I'd driving around with my big hair and my big feet, you know, and some lady tripped over my feet tonight, and I felt proud. They are out there, aren't they, you know, and I had a little girlfriend named Loopy, and she had her hair up real big, and we'd drive around with our frowns on, wondering what the hell you're staring at, you know, what are you looking at, you know, and we were frowning because our asses hurt from driving around like that all day, you know, and I ran into a kid like that not too long ago, a couple years ago. I was in the Glendale Mall, and walking through the mall by myself, and some kid walks by, and he's all shaved, bald, you know, and he's about 19 years old. He's all tatted down. He's got a tank top on. He's got these big pants. You could put about five kids in there, you know. He's got about three phones because he's an important kid, you know. And I walk by him. He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a star here. He's got a diamond here. He's got a ring in his lip. He's got a ball bearing in his tongue. He's got a chain to his wallet. And I walk by him. He goes, what are you looking at? I said, I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. Beats the hell out of me what I'm looking at, son, you know. And we started talking, and now I sponsor the kid. And he's down in Chula Vista calling me up. What do you want me to do? I said, my God, Ron, why don't you unlock yourself for Christ's sake, you know? Yeah, well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different. Really? Maybe it's because you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence. Does that have anything to do with it, you know? But I understand that. That ain't about being bad or anything like that. I've always been a man of images. I've always had to have some type of image behind. You know, whether it be a little loser or wino or slipper in AA, I've always had something to hide behind. And then when you run out of images, you got your ace in the hole, which is your hostility. And I tell you, that fooled me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I remember being about 90 days sober. And I'm telling my sponsor, I said, my God, I feel like such a phony. He says, I understand. He says, you know what that, you know why that is? He says, because you're used to being a phony your entire life. And what phonies do is they put on a suit and a masquerade. And he says, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says, you have a new group of people, a new vocabulary, a new atmosphere, and you put on this suit of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one more time, your head thinks you're playing a game. He says, but this isn't a suit for you to hide behind. This is one that once you work the steps, you'll fill out and wear. And for the first time in all your life, you'll stay and become what God wants you to become. That you don't have to run anymore, you see. Greatest news my sponsor ever told me is that everything you need to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry. He says, I love you like a son. Everything you need that God needs you to have to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, son, anything that hinders that happiness is going to be removed by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to go anywhere to get anything else done. Everything an alcoholic needs to fulfill his role in life will can be done right here. What a wonderful piece of news that was for me. And I had no idea, and my sponsor simmered me down. And like I said, I started driving around with these little lowriders for a long time, and I had a good life, and I loved it, and the picture was opening up all the time. And then around 1969, a bunch of us took off to Detroit to find my roots, and we wound up in Phoenix. And over there off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, you know, overlooking the Wagon Wheel Bar, you know, and I got me a little room that's about $35 a month, you know, and I got a hot plate and a hot TV, and I look out this little window and just stare at the bar till it opens, you know, and I drink and I dream and I die, and I know that one of these days it ain't going to be like that. You know, and I get these little jobs with a plumber, and my first job was with this plumber, and he stuck me underneath a house, you know, and all he wanted me to do was string out some pipes because we were going to do a repipe. He said, just string them out, kid. That's all you got to do is string out the pipes. And he took off, and I'm underneath this house, you know, and I got a pint of Kessler's, got a little transistor radio, a little cat staring at me, you know, and I go crawling over to the vent hole, you know, and I look out the vent hole and I go, Jesus, man, I got it made under here. You know, I'm on top of the world, you know. I got a pint of Kessler's, I got a cat, you know. I'm getting paid by the hour. Every now and then, you know, I'll bang on the pipe to let them know I'm there, you know. And I crawl back over, cap the seal of that thing, throw that warm whiskey down, and 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath that house, you know, and apparently I busted through the bedroom crawl space and I ransacked the lady's jewelry box and took it all underneath the house, you know, and I'm passed out and the cat's got all this jewelry on her, you know. And so I got fired from that job, you know, and then I became a tuxedo salesman door to door, you know, in the middle of June, you know, over there in Phoenix. Hey, look at this, Betty, you know, and that lasted for about 3 hours, you know, and then I got a job for another plumber, and I'm digging this ditch, and I find out that the kid's younger than me, and I'm not digging a ditch for a kid. I got my pride, you know. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury, and they took me to the hospital, and I got a prescription for Percodan. And me and my buddies at the Wagon Wheel Bar, we started drinking our whiskey, and we come up with some ideas that some guy knew some doctors down in Tucson and Nogales and drove me down there, and I got a new profession. I started writing prescriptions and selling them, prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and Tuanol and Obitrol, and you name it all, I wrote it all. damn near took it all too, you know. And after about 10 months, they caught up with me. And, you know, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes down the 13 freeway. You know, and ain't none of that happening, you know. It's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, well, there's that son of a bitch under there, you know. So they finally arrested me, you know, and poured me into the car, convicted me, and I'm in southern Arizona for about 9 or 10 months or something like that, and they gave me a $40 voucher to come back to California. 1974, I check in with the L.A. City Hall, and they give me a little room over in Torrance, the Greyhound Hotel, and I'm sober for about 2 months, and I meet my little sister. I hadn't seen my little... I have two sisters that flat adore me, and I had no idea about that, that I was their hero. Had no idea about that. And my little sister asked me, she says, yeah, I'm glad that you're not drinking. She says, because I need your help. She says, me and my husband got to go to Monterey and look at a house. And we need you to watch the house from Friday to Monday. And we can't pay you, but all we want you to do is stay in there, get the mail, and walk the dog. That's all you got to do. She says, and if you could just do that, we can take care of business. And we'd really, and I wanted to be in her good graces, you know. I wanted to be in the family's graces, you know. And so that they took off, and I'm 2 months without drinking, and they take off, and I walk the dog, and I start bringing in her mail. I'm reading it for her, you know, and Saturday comes along, and I get the Daily Breeze newspaper, and Ali's fighting, and I love to watch Ali fight. I love to drink Thunderbird wine and watch him. I like to have Jiffy Pop and some Thunderbird and watch Ali fight. And but I can't do that because I got the dog, the mail, and I want to be good and all that. Besides, I ain't got no dough. I ain't got a penny on me. Not one penny. There's not a penny in this house. There's got to be a penny in this house. Somewhere in this house, in the garage, and I start looking for that penny. I'm going through drawers. I'm going through toolboxes. Finally, Uriah Heep out in the garage is a 5-gallon sparkless bottle full of pennies. And I start shaking that thing out till I get $1.29 for the wine bottle. Shake a little more for the Jiffy Pop. Run down there, and this thing's like an engine, like an engine. Drink, 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 and it won't leave me alone. And I run down to Hahn's liquor store, get me a couple bottles of Thunderbird, cap that seal, and that's all I remember till Monday morning. Where one more time, her husband's dragging me out of the house. I'm stone cold sober, and I'm watching as I go by the TV, and it's busted. The couch has got knife slices in it. The picture window is busted like a chair, and the curtains are blowing through it. He's dragging me down, and my head's hitting the steps. And I go by, believe me, little feet that are my sister's, and she's crying. The gate's open, and the dog's gone. And he's calling me every name that I've called myself, but he's making it out. And along those lines, or don't you ever come around us again. Why don't you just leave everybody in the family alone, Larry, you know? And for me to go to my little room and get arrested one more time for being a public nuisance. And for 4 months, I'm sitting up at the L.A. County Jail. And these guys are all around me, and they're talking about what they're going to do when they leave. One guy's going back to his house. One guy's going back to his job. And the only thought that I have for 4 months is I've got a half pint of Kessler's whiskey hidden by a tree. And every night, that baby put me to sleep. And every day, I would think about seeing that little thing when I get out, how I'm going to run down 190th, and how I'm going to go to the fourth tree on the fifth row, and there's going to be that whiskey. And every night that would put me to sleep. And I finally get out, and I run down to that tree, and I'm running off away from the RTD bus, and I go to the tree, and it's not there. And I go to the next tree, and it's not there. I go to about 4 trees, and they're not there. The cops come. They know I'm not a gardener, you know, and they arrest me one more time. And I come out, and I'm 2 months sober, and I'm on Anabuse. And in 1974, I'm in a Little League dugout over in El Segundo, California, 10 o'clock in the morning, absolutely sober, out of my mind, in between hysterical and maniacal. I've never been to a place like that before, and I knew this was the end. I had no idea what was going on, and there wasn't an ounce of alcohol in me. And the paramedics come, they diagnose that I'm something goofy, and they took me to the Harbor General Hospital, where they see that some of my episodes that I need to be put away to be observed for 30 days. And so they sent me to a state hospital out there by Oxnard to be observed. And about 13 months later, they leave me, I'm out. And I'm totally observed by this time. And they give me my antidepressants and my antipsychotics, and they told me that I would never be able to operate in society unless I took those things. And after 2 months, I ran out of Thorazine. And they found me over to Overo Street, curled up behind a Chevron station, a public drunk, a public nuisance. They sent me up to Wayside for a violation, and after about 3 months, they sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm sitting in a holding tank about this size. It's a concrete floor. I got my Vons bag and no hope, and I'm just staring at the door, hoping I can hear some keys. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. And he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Why don't you come with me, son?" He says, "We're going to go to AA. AA? I've never heard of that before. I've heard of OR and PO, you know, but what's AA, you know?" And this beautiful man had no business being there. Had no business being there. He was what they call a trusted servant. Trusted servant isn't something that you're nominated to or elected to. Trusted servant is the first thing you give a guy when he's new here. Something that he holds on to as he stays here. That you're going to carry this message without charging a dime. That for fun and for free, you're going to tote this thing, and your primary purpose in life will be to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wherever you can, do whatever you can. And that man had no business being there. In fact, that guy had the worst news of his life that day, and that is his wife was dying of an immediate terminal disease. And he knew that she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his book studies and somewhere in his teachings of Alcoholics Anonymous, he grasped and developed that first paragraph of Working with Others, where it talks about practical experience will tell us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. And he turned his little car around and he went back to the courthouse and he asked Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth if there was anybody down there he could talk to. And they said, "We got a guy that may want to listen to you." And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm expecting a long ride and maybe some lunch. You know, he took me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This little club over there in Torrance called the TLC Club, you know, and it looked so dingy. I thought, what is this? Were they going to start handing out cheese or something here, you know? And I walked into this TLC Club and this little, you know, and he introduced me to all these people, a little lady named Moose and Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. I said, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Little Moose comes running after me. "Hi, honey, I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I said, "I'm not it, you know." Some transvestite came around the corner and he started circling me like a blimp, you know, and he finally landed, you know, and he came over. He says, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so. Not till I get a year anyway, you know." I told this, I said, "My God, that guy's got big feet, you know." And I looked around that room and I said, "My God, if this is AA, I don't want any part of it. And if that's the effect of that blue book, I don't want to crack that thing open either." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months, and that's because I was on heroin. And every time I came back, took the edge off, you know. And every time I came back, I wanted to get sober. But I never found out what an alcoholic was. I never found out what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I made one important discovery. And that was that if I don't change, my sobriety date will. And I don't have the power to change. But I know that I can't live this way of life in my old lifestyle. And my God, I wanted to do that. The easiest thing for a guy like me to do is to hang on to his selfishness, his self-centeredness, and his ripping and running. And the hardest thing to do is to cross that invisible line over to your way of life. Hardest thing for me to do. I hung on to every old idea I had, and it would get me drunk. And every time I'd come back, I wanted to stay sober, and I wanted to get my life together. Never once got a sponsor, never once applied these steps to my life, never once sat down with people and made amends and paid the money back. You know? Worst years of my life. And on May 2nd, 1980, I'm over at Don Hotel in Wilmington. I got about 15 days sober, and every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they were always clean and they were sharp. And one of the neatest things that I have in my life today is taking a shower, getting ready to see you. Something happens to me when I start doing that. It's caused a series of actions called extra efforts. And I start dressing up to come and see and be with you. My sponsor taught me a long time ago that if you can't show respect for the thing that's saving your life, what makes you think you're going to show respect for anything else? Everything starts in here, Larry. And in 1980, I'm up at that hotel room, and I've got about 15 days sober, and Don comes in there, this guy from Alcoholics Anonymous, and every time I called, somebody would come and get me, and they never asked me any questions. They always say, are you ready to go to a meeting? And this guy, every time I called this bald-headed carpenter, he'd show up, and he showed up that day, and he started knocking on the door. Said, who is it? Larry, it's Don. I said, my God, it's the guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know? He opens up the door, and he goes, oh, my God, you had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you new guys, you know. He says, what's going on, kid? And I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle, and I told Don, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Why don't you just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic for my entire life. Let me do what I want to do. In the moment that I said that, it struck a chord in the back of my neck that struck me back to when I was 16 years old, and me and my dad were fighting, and he kicks me out of the house for getting drunk and selling dope. And he says, if you want to live that way, that's your business. But I got two daughters and a wife, and you ain't going to do it here, hotshot. And I went after that old man, and me and him had a fight. And for year after year after year, I would joke about that fight, and I would pride myself on that fight. But at the end of every evening, when I was home alone, I would always think about that man and what I did, and the shame that it made me feel. And while all my friends would go party, you know where you would find me a lot of times? You'd find me at a bar where there's people twice my age, saddled up next to a guy that reminded me of my dad. Talk to him like I wished I could talk to my dad. See, that's not the kind of conversations I was having with my dad. Or you'd find me saddled up next to somebody that reminded me of my mom, because I couldn't talk to my mom, and I'd be talking to these gals that were reminding me of my mom, because I knew I'd mistreated them, you know? And everything that got, you know, everything for about 15 seconds, all those memories come back. And the only answer to life I've ever had turned around and walked out of that room, that bald-headed carpenter. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you, and I can't stay drunk and I can't stay sober. On May 2nd, 1982, I'm down at that mission. I'm checking into that mission one more time, and I look at myself in that Woolworth window, and I'm about 120 pounds, and I'm yellow, and I got my shoes tied to my feet and my hair down to my shoulders, and I got my street mud on. And I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. What the hell's going on? How come I'm always getting drunk and I'm always getting sober and there's nothing in between, you know? And I did what I always did when I got that way. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, why don't you get your rusty ass down here yourself? He says, if you know where we are and what we got, why don't you get your rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you, son. He says, that sign says we care. He says, I'll be damned if I'm going to take care of you. And you hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? I just heard it. I just heard it, and for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer up to the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by me. Now it was up to me to come to you, and I took the longest walk of my life. I walked that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope, waddled up to a club that I was kicked out of, and in that walk, I discovered what an alcoholic was. All my life, I'm thinking I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic. I better not drink. And it finally dawned on me. I'm an alcoholic. I'm gonna drink. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. That alcoholics, that I am in the grip of a progressive illness. It has me. I don't have it. And it'll always have me. And what Alcoholics Anonymous does is just loosen the little grip enough for me to live a good life. But I will never have a life. There is not a lifestyle that'll relieve me from alcoholism. This is the only thing for me. There's not a living condition in the world to keep a guy like me from drinking. Not amount of love or poverty, riches, money, nothing. It all comes from that me and you carrying this message seems to be the only relief a guy like me gets. That I'm always going to have this thing. And that I'm never going to get off it. And I kept thinking that if I hit a bottom enough, this would do it. You know? And that it just, you know what, man? I'm always going to be drinking. I'm the kind of guy that's on the emergency table with hoses passing through them. And the only thought that I have is when I get off here, I'm going to Eddie's Liquor Store. You know? Make that go away. You know? And I walked down and I walked to that guy and I asked this man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And he told me under no certain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. You make the effort, I make the effort. And that guy was my sponsor for a year and a half. And at 2 years, I started running the show again. I started keeping secrets. I started judging my first sponsor. I started getting this gap, and I started running my own life sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at 2 years sober, a man came down to the meeting at that club, and I could no longer survive on the junk food of AA. I needed some meat and potatoes, and I needed to know where they were serving it. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he says, why don't you just show up and start showing up to a home group? And at 2 years sober, I finally got a home group. I never had a home group before. And I showed up at this meeting, and it became my home group over 23 years ago. And all I do there is make coffee, clean the coffee pots 3 times a week. It's the most magnificent thing I have in my home group. And my sponsor we went through these steps and we started making amends to people. And I got to sit my mom and my dad down and be introduced to the finest people I've ever met in my life. Nothing like them. There was nothing like my mom and dad. And I love my mom to this day. I called up my wife a couple weeks ago and I said, Rosie, I says, I'm cheating on you. She goes, what's going on? I says, I'm taking mom on dates. And I've been taking my mom out because I love the time we have. And become best friends with my dad before he passed away. This 250-pound refinery worker started getting his little pancreas cancer and stuff like that. And it was my great privilege to go over there and take care of him. You see, it was my time to step up to the plate and do something for this guy that introduced me to this scene. We become best of friends, you know. He told me when I was 5 years sober, he says, don't wait till I'm sick in the hospital to come see me, son. He says, I love having you around. He says, you're living a life that's all I've ever wanted for you, is to live the good life. And he says, you seem to be doing that. And me and my dad become dear friends, and I think about them all the time, because at the every meeting we hold hands, and year after year after year, men are giving me cakes, and I'm giving cakes to guys, and we're hugging and we're holding hands, and when it came time for me to show my dad affection, I could do it without feeling weird, because I would go visit my dad and kiss him on his little forehead and tell him that I love you, Dad, and everything's gonna be all right. Just let me know what you want me to do, Pop, you know. And he'd get up his little 80-pound body with his Dodger hat on and, it's good to see you, son. I need you to make this check out and stuff like that, you know. I had a great time with him. But he's not gone. He's in my mind every time we say that our Father. I got a picture. I got a great picture. See, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous introduces this kind of stuff to a guy like me. Where he's not supposed to see a little girl that's his daughter. Because of a nasty divorce. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous say, you may not be somebody's husband, but you're always going to be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at, Larry. And I started writing my little girl letters. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous got mad at me because I was using that big yellow legal stuff. They said, you better use Pocahontas, you son of a bitch. You know. And now for 19 years, that little girl knows where I'm at. I got to see that little girl walk down a little aisle and get her little diploma. You know, and because she's in Phoenix doesn't mean that I don't see her. If I can go all over the country and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, why can't I drive to Phoenix and see my little girl? What's more spiritual? And my little girl's doing good. She called me up not too long ago, said the kids are making fun of her because she's so smart. She said, Daddy, did that ever happen to you? I says, you bet it did, you know. So I got the shock of my lifetime. About 6 months ago, I went to do my little visit to my daughter, and I drove over there, and I seen my daughter, and my daughter shows up, and we do our daddy-daughter date, and at the end of the evening, she yawns, and her little T-shirt rises, and baby's got a tattoo. Baby doesn't have a little bumblebee. Baby has a mural of the county jail going. She's got these two big roses, and I wanted to go after her. But I remembered what you folks told me. Shut your mouth. Don't say what you think. Just shut your mouth. And I pretend like I didn't see it. And I told my sponsor. And we're talking. He says, don't you ever bring it up. He says, I know you call her every day, but don't you ever bring it up. And every time I called her, I wanted to, is it still there? You know, is it getting bigger? You know, I tell you what happened. A couple months ago, she needed to talk to me about something important. I was so glad that I never brought up the tattoo. Because if she needed to talk to me about something important, that thought would have came, oh shit, I can't. He blew up about the tattoo. He won't know how to handle this. And I went and seen my daughter, and she had something to tell me. And there she was. And she had her ears pierced. She had a ball bearing in her nose. She had a ball bearing in her lip, and she had a tattoo. And she looks at me, and she says, what are you looking at? I said, probably the most prettiest little girl I've ever seen in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to see behind the gear. That behind the tattoo and the ring and all this other stuff, there's a little girl in there, and she's my daughter. Now, I didn't get that by driving around alone in a plumbing truck. I got that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where our common welfare comes first. That regardless of where you've come from and what you've done, that there's an alcoholic in there. And it's up to me to talk to that alcoholic and not his image. My common welfare depends on me and you talking about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and the disease of identification, the lost art of AA, me, you, and that book. Regardless of what we've come from, I hope we never lose that art of identification, because that's why I'm here right now, is because you're my people. You're the only ones that understand how I think and feel and live. And it's the only place that I've ever gone where I don't feel different, and people aren't shocked by my behavior. This isn't the place where you try to up one. Thank God when I did my fifth step, my sponsor wasn't shocked. You know, reading that thing along and just hearing him go, oh my God, you what? Get out of this car, you know. You shouldn't even have any pets, for Christ's sakes, you know. You know. Thank God in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, you cannot shock us, because we have that magical word that not a therapist and not a priest can give us, and that is, you know what, pal? I've done that too, and this is what we're going to do about it. And that's the job of a sponsor, not to become a prison warden, not to become a daddy, not to become a mommy, is to shave down and round out the very thing that alcoholics drink over, and that is eventually when they're sober, they'll begin to feel different about something. Whether it be about their past or present life, alcoholics like to hang on to these shit magnets to feel different about. And it's a job as a sponsor, when you cough up these fur balls, for him to say, no, not your, I know that's weird, but you're not that different. Quit, you know, don't use that. You're not, everything's going to be all right. And that's what my sponsor does. He keeps shaving off these differences from these fur balls that I keep coughing up, because I know that if I feel comfortable enough with whatever's going on with me, I can hear the message. But if I'm in here focusing on how different I feel about something, I'll lose it. And my sponsor always just, that's why, if I start lying to my sponsor, this whole thing becomes a lie again. It's another big facade, parade, nonsense, drunk. I've got to be honest somewhere, and it starts right there. I can always tell how a person lives by how they behave in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys are like a book. You can always tell about the people who are living well because they conduct themselves in a certain way in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys are an easy read. All my life, I've had this question about a God and His presence. I didn't come from a religious. I was scared to death about this thing called God. He killed my little brother when I was 5, and I thought I was next. I didn't know nothing about a God. I didn't want to hear about that. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and meeting after meeting after meeting, I see my living God. Because row after row after row, I see people who should be dead. And tonight at Lake Mead, we're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. We've got the evidence of a power right here. And every time I see you, I'm playing with the evidence. Though I may not see the big thing, I'm playing with His kids. I'm playing in the evidence of a power much greater than I'll ever, ever be, and one that I'll always need. I love the way I feel when I'm with you. I love the things that I see when I'm meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's an old man that I used to go see in Flagstaff, and he'd have me talk up at his meeting every year. And he had a beautiful home in Flagstaff. And the neat thing about this home was that in every window, he had a peak view of the mountains. Whether you were in the den, the bathroom, or the kitchen, he had a peak view. And as I stand here tonight, in every area of my life, I got a peak view. And in every window, you're in it. I can't look out any window of my life without seeing the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I hope you come with us and share with us on this happy road to destiny. Thank you.